The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am pleased to see so many of you here this evening. Rather than tell you why Barry Lopez is such a revered and important writer, rather than enumerate his impressive achievements, awards, and bona fides, I thought I'd strew a few laurels from his peers before we begin. Barry Lopez is a straight-up magnificent writer. To read Horizon is to be transported to wondrous landscapes far beyond the pale, and thereby obtain an astounding perspective on our increasingly uncertain future. Lopez expresses faith that our species can avert annihilation by investing more deeply in the cardinal virtues, courage, justice, reverence, and compassion. Virtues this book possesses in abundance. John Krakauer. No one has worked harder to make sense of our present civilization than Barry Lopez, and in these chronicles we get to share the travels that helped shape his extraordinary mind and heart, a great gift to us all, Bill McKibben. A celebration and investigation of the impulse to explore, Horizon is itself an exploration of both the human and inhuman worlds. In his intensity, his clarity, and his capacity for wonder, Barry Lopez is unmatched. Elizabeth Colbert. It's all true. Dear reader, a world awaits, not all of it beautiful. Please welcome Barry Lopez.
Thank you. I've started walking with this cane, so now when I come out on a stage, I don't know what to do with it. There it is. It's all set now. Thank you, Andy. I thought that I would, it's impossible with a book this big to describe exactly what it is. I think an important thing to remember about it is that I wanted at this point in my life, after many years of travel all over the world, to write about the world that I saw on reflection, which necessitated writing something about who I am and who I was. So I've just picked a place here that strikes a note about the kind of country that I moved through, in this case in Australia, and some of the things that I saw. So I was with six other people. We were traveling in Western Australia, the state of Western Australia, and we were headed to a place, called the Pilbara, which is an iron ore mining region in Western Australia. And the idea was the country had been profoundly disturbed by industrial mining. And the greatest disruption was the obliteration of the social order of Aboriginal people there. So there was a group in Perth called Form, and their idea was if they could go into the Pilbara and begin working with Aboriginal people, perhaps they would be able, through workshops of one sort or another, to bring some psychic order to the place. So what Form wanted to do is bring me and a photographer and a painter and take us through the region. And the first place we were going to go is to a part of Western Australia that was completely undisturbed, called the Karajini National Park. So we stayed overnight in a little town called Tom Price, and we went into Karajini. So this is where the story picks up. The seven of us were up and gone from Tom Price before sunrise, driving unpaved roads that took us into the heart of Karajini, a landscape that looked as if it were still damp from the creation. Paul had been all through this country before, photographing, and Larry had seen a good bit of it as well. We descended into and climbed out of deep desert canyons, narrow fissures in a rolling plain that rose to imposing heights in the Hammersley Range, to the north and west of us. A brilliant magenta shield dotted with white bark gum trees and clumps of golden-colored spinifex grass. The crystalline air was shot through with bird calls, and flocks of white little corellas and pink galahs passed so closely over us we could hear the creak of ligaments in their wings. We swam in still pools of cool water and in slow-moving rivers in the bottoms of several of the gorges, out of the direct rays of the sun, but with the brightness of its incident light ricocheting off walls of 2 billion-year-old rock, walls in every shade of purple one might catalog, from damson to heliotrope, from hyacinth to raisin, each purple changing hue as the hours passed and as the sun's reflected rays became direct, creating a harsher light. In one canyon we hiked into, we stopped for a while where a narrow river bar had formed and several river red gums and weeping paper barks had taken root. Jeweled geckos ran the vertical walls on either side of the canyon, great slabs of incinerated blacks and bronzed purples. As I lay back on cool, sandy soil, a flock of about 20 zebra finches passed over the narrow strip of blue above the canyon. Small, brightly colored passerines with large bills and barred tails, quick as a school of mackerel. They were gone before their wooting cries reached the floor of the canyon where we lay. Up on the plain, in great reaches of hummocky grassland to either side of the red-orange dirt tracks on which we drove, termite mounds rose higher than the tallest of us stood. Red kangaroos and common wallaroos, suddenly alert as our trucks rolled to a stop, bounded away, drawing the eye to bare escarpment walls rising at the base of the Hammersley Range. The traditional owners here are the Banyajima, the Yingwanka, and the Karamura people. Their occupancy goes back more than 30,000 years. To an outlander, the countryside appears primordial, but it has been shaped by these people's hunting and gathering strategies and by the fires they've deliberately set, pursuing their fire stick style of farming. Mags and Carolyn had wanted the five of us to see Karajini, to establish a kind of baseline awareness of the country we would be traveling through by comparison with which Karajini appears completely untouched. Leaving there, we swung north toward Dampier, situated at the far end of the Tom Price Railway Road, which parallels the tracks that convey the iron ore trains out of the Hammersley Range toward the deepwater harbors at Dampier and at Port Hedland. As we left the park, an open pit iron ore mine called Marandu shares a boundary with Karajini on three of its four sides. The signs of human infrastructure quickly emerged from the otherwise apparently untenanted land. Fence lines declaring exclusive ownership, and the many modern conduits for water, electricity, fuel, and information. Power line pylons, cell phone towers, and pipelines. Inscribed amid these was a maze of improved and primitive roads, from sealed bitumen two-lane highways to roads too dangerous, our maps warned, to attempt in a single vehicle. In such spots, a convoy is preferable, where mutual aid ensures some success, at least in dealing with flash flood washouts, drifting sand, and broken axles. The maps also warned us away from areas closed to the public, abandoned mining towns like Wittenoom, where asbestos fibers still swirling in the air are too easily inhaled. Loaded iron ore trains gain on us and roll past as we drive north, trains too long for us to be able to see both ends in the same moment, each end lying as it does over the curve of the earth. The longest train ever documented passed this way in 1993. It consisted of 682 iron ore cars pushed from behind and pulled ahead by 8 diesel-electric locomotives. It was nearly 4.5 miles long and was carrying 110,000 tons of ore. During each 24-hour cycle in the Pilbara, approximately 11 such trains arrive at Dampier and Port Hedland. Most are composed of more than 300 cars, each bearing about 160 tons of pulverized ore. The dark umber mounds sitting inert in the cars, leveled off in the shape of neat trapezoids, follow each other like a series of mountain ranges. At some point on the Tom Price Road, we cross a broad, dry watercourse, its floodplain bounded on either side by a gallery forest of gum trees. On our right at that moment, an ore train is passing. On our left, a group of 8 Aboriginal people are standing still in the riverbed, fixated on the train. Dressed in threadbare clothes, carrying cloth bundles holding their possessions, the group has the look of an extended family. For people whose psychological anchor in stressful times is in part the immediacy, the intimate closeness of the physical country they were born to, and whose guiding stories are inextricably woven into that land, the passage of the train is traumatic. Its very presence signifies their loss of ownership and denial of access to their ancestors' lands. This is an old story in Australia, in the Americas, on the Tibetan Plateau, and elsewhere. But now, before them in the cars, is the very country itself being shipped off somewhere. For a Christian, a Muslim, or a Jew, it would be as if Jerusalem and the ground it stood on had been put through a rock crusher, and the gravel of the tombs, the temples, the churches, and the prayer walls had been hauled away by NASA to build dormitories on the moon.
Barry, thank you for that exquisitely observed story. In all earnestness, are we doomed?
Are we doomed? Well, you know, every animal is doomed. It's just a matter of how it plays out, you know. I mean, many people must have said that the coelacanth was doomed, but it turned up again in the Indian Ocean in 1938, so I don't think in terms of whether or not we're doomed. I think it's clear to anybody who looks at the disintegration of democratic order in the United States or at the rampant viral epidemics that we have now that we didn't have 40 years ago, all of it from a disturbance that we have created. You know, we have millions of economic refugees, millions of environmental or ecological refugees. So I think if you step back and took a close look at everything, you would just shake your head and take the door into despair. I think the hard thing for people now is to find something to be in contact with that didn't destroy your sense of hope.
And your sense of hope is still intact.
Oh, that's a tough one. I could sit here and say, as I think I do somewhere in the book, that in my life I've seen every commandment violently broken, and I've seen the dead and the dying in many places. You know, Afghanistan comes to mind right away. But I also see I also sense that there is a path through this, and it is certainly not a path that could be built by governments or built by business infrastructure of one sort or another. It can only be built by the will of a group of people to not go under. 10 years ago, when I sensed that I myself was, that I had become isolated in my view of the world. I mean, I have argued all of my life for a diversity of experience. I think one thing that's killing us is the retreat into our own identities and the belief that we're exceptional and we can figure out anything and solve the problem. Obviously, that's not the case. We can't even get international cooperation on things as straightforwardly dangerous as global climate change. But I could feel myself that I was existing in a world of complacency about so much of this. So I went to a friend who runs an international aid operation and said, can you help me design a trip that will take me for 6 weeks or so just across a landscape of human plight? And he said, yes, we can do that. So I ended up flying to Beirut and spent a lot of time going through Palestinian refugee camps and the whole shockwave of the Middle East hit me every night during the day, and I lay awake in my bed in some hotel at night thinking, my God in heaven, how is anybody going to prevent a human disaster here? And from there I went to Tajikistan because I wanted to see how this most impoverished of the old Soviet republics was doing, 85% unemployment. So I was there for a while, and then I flew over the Hindu Kush into Kabul. And one night at dinner, my host said, the worst thing the Taliban did here was to destroy those two Buddhas in their grottos in Bamiyan. And that had happened about 2 years, I think, before I got there. But I said to him, if you can arrange this, because it requires security, travel with security, I bet I can learn as much from those empty grottos as I could have learned seeing the Buddhas themselves several years before that. So he arranged that, and I went to Bamiyan, and it was, as they say, a teaching experience. And from there, I went to northern Sumatra, to Banda Aceh, and this was shortly after the tsunami, the Boxing Day tsunami, the December 26th, 2004, I guess, tsunami hit. So 225,000 people died in about 20 minutes there. And when I left there, I went home by way of a couple of planes, but I ended up in Jakarta. And I called my wife from Jakarta, and I said, I'm coming home, and I have to tell you that I feel more hope for humanity now than I did when I got off the plane in Beirut. And the reason for that is, in all of those places, I saw the way that human beings instinctively know how to take care of themselves and their children in a landscape where it's disaster one day after another. And if you ask me if I have a sense of hope, I would say that's coming. Landscapes of disaster. So the real question is, how are we going to take care of each other? And that's what I wanted to write about. it's not so much a sense of hope, it's a sense of faith in humanity. Our days are full of terrible people doing terrible, selfish things, and it's given to us as news, and it's just rubbish in the sense that a full-grown human being, an adult, you know, is attracted to news like that the way children are attracted to cotton candy. You indulge yourself and then you feel empty. And the real thing you want to hear is, where are people doing really well in stressful circumstances? But, you know, the next 30 years seemed like a make it or break it period for Homo sapiens, for me. And I don't mean to say, oh, what a terrible thing. We still have an imagination, and we are still able to manage superhuman things. The evidence of it is there every day in the presence of anonymous people. I really resist the idea of the hero coming across the horizon and saving us from our errors. The heroic for me these days is in the community, a heroic community that has got adults running the show, you know, people that no longer need to be supervised, that can be trusted to do the right thing, which means don't worry about yourself, worry about the others. I see that everywhere. And I'm reluctant to say it makes me hopeful, that the size of this river, the power behind the change that's coming is more than any human being can manage. But we've found our way through the Black Plague, and there are other examples of how we've taken care of each other. The stakes now are really big.
I want to circle back to a section of the book that is called Talismans. Hmm. And you write of your collection of talismans in your home, the Real de Ocho and the tongue-shaped sandstone, which seem to carry some of the most symbolic freight for the narrative that follows, or the narratives that follow. Would you tell us a little bit about each and what they represent to you? Because I think it connects with exactly what you're talking about.
My stepfamily came to the Americas in 1519. My ancestor, Marin Lopez, built Cortez's ships on Lake Xochimilco for the invasion of Tenochtitlan, which is Mexico City. And I didn't feel any kind of personal responsibility for what happened in the wake of the invasion of the Americas, but I wanted to be reminded of it and what was at stake and how brutally people were treated. So I came on this coin, a Real de Ocho, in I purchased it. It was from a Spanish shipwreck that had been discovered once, and then 300 years later was discovered again. And this coin had been salvaged from that shipwreck. And it reminded me of my stepfamily and the incomprehensible brutality of the Spanish invasion of the so-called New World. So I kept it around to remind me of the brutal reality that I was trying to find language to describe, but as is the case in the book, not to terrify people, but just say, all right, for the grown-ups, this is what we have to deal with, and what do you think? And that stone you refer to that I saw on a beach in San Salvador, the island of San Salvador in the Bahamas, looked like a human tongue, and the circumstances under which I saw it were A friend of mine and I had come to San Salvador to dive, and there is there underwater a monument to Columbus, and I wanted to go see that monument. So we were walking by it one day at noon at siesta time, there's nobody else around, and I just had this impulse to go and see this thing and was seething with anger about it and what it represented. So I took all of my clothes off and swam out until I was treading water above it and worked that anger out of myself. And then when I swam back to shore, my feet touched the bottom and I began walking toward the beach, and I was so exhausted I went down on my knees and hands trying to catch my breath. And right in front of me I saw this stone that looked like a human tongue. And what I had been doing as I walked out of the shallows and up onto the beach was an unanticipated emotional outpouring about injustice, human injustice in the world, toward all kinds of people. Most of the shouting being done by people like me, white men, and in my way trying to make an apology, which is kind of a silly thing, and I mean, it's just how you behave when you're confronted with enormous indignity and violence and horror. And I picked that stone up and it looked like a human tongue, and I felt this has something to do with what I'm trying to do. So over a period of time, I mean a very long time in many countries, I would have these kinds of encounters that I think all of us do. You know, the object means to another person, I mean, nothing, you know, it's just too innocuous. But these things were reminders to me to not forget. And they're placed in my house so that I see them almost every day, and they're reminders that it's like saying to myself, you got to go to all of these places because of what you do with your life as a writer. But most people don't get to do that. They have to put food on the table, they have to change diapers, they have to pay taxes, they have to do all of the things that just take up your life, raising children properly, for example. And I didn't have children until late in my life, so I didn't have any of those things, and I had a ferocious hunger to go and see the world outside of the one that I was born to. So these things are around the house, and when I'm moving through the house, I'm thinking, they are saying, don't forget, don't forget. You've got to do all this, and you have to come back and write a story so the rest of us who didn't get to go can see something and find in what you're laying out a reason for each of us to go on. It sounds grandiose, I guess, but it's the only way I've known how to behave as a writer.
Well, it seems that the themes you talk about with regard to each of those talismans and some of the other ones that you enumerate in the book, obviously, they, as you said, you go from country to country and you carry these with you and yeah. explore them in each country that you write about in the book, or each right. area of terrain. You have an immense respect for the lost knowledge, rituals, and interior states of indigenous cultures throughout right. your travels, obviously. Given our highly technical and commodified culture, and this might, what is the value of recovering these intangibles beyond a romantic yearning for what has been lost? And well, I'm just sort of throwing that out there, expecting
I can remember answer. When I was working on Arctic Dreams, walking through villages, through Eskimo villages, and participating with these people in their daily life And then on my own, you know, in the middle of a sunlit summer, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning and the sun is bright and you're walking between dwellings and just crying. Because I could not understand how this could, everything here is falling apart and what is being lost is just, it's unmeasurable in one sense, but the people who are responsible for tearing it apart never cared whether it was be a whole piece of fabric or not. It just all got used up. So over decades of traveling with indigenous people in the far north and in the Northern Territory and in Africa, I would ask myself, what is going on here with indigenous groups? They're despised by the so-called Western world and dismissed as unimportant, unimaginative, unworthy, you know, all of the words that condescend. And I thought, you know, that just can't be true. And I would say that because occasionally I would find myself in conversation with elders in different traditions, and the illumination that would be there would always make me think, whatever happened to this kind of conversation, which I never heard about when I was in college or in an anthropology course? Why was all of this thrown away? Because the test of human social organization is whether it lasts. So if you're traveling with Aboriginal people and you're not trying to apply middle-class values about what's important in life, you realize that these people have been living successfully from generation to generation 30 or 40 or 50,000 years. That's a very long time to persist and to consistently make the right decisions about how to manage the kind of human difficulty that all of us encounter in whatever culture every day. So that drove at me, and I don't want to be somebody other than I am. I don't want to live in some other culture than my own. But I could never understand how can we have thrown this away? This is the key to survival. I mean, once you step away and you're no longer mesmerized by Ferraris and television and presidential politics, or once you just push all that stuff out of the way, children's toys, all of that, and say, well, we're in really serious trouble. Who has been here before and what do they know about survival? And the people that consistently knew most about survival were elders in these traditional societies. I don't mean older people. I mean women and men who are the repositories of what needs to be recalled in order to survive. They're the people that you go to find out what counts and what doesn't. For the most part, these people, that you can talk to them for an hour and you'll never hear the first person singular pronoun, I. And I've had many people say to me, how can you stand to be around traditional people? You know, there's no intellectual conversation. And well, that's a stupid thing to say, but you can't respond in that way because it's a judgment about somebody who's of a different race or a different religious conviction or is organized epistemologically, you know, the way they see the world in a different way than you are. To me, the trouble that is coming is not going to be managed by any one particular group. It's going to be managed by a conversation across these lines that we've drawn between ourselves, between men and women, between the elderly and the young. We're going to have to cross all of those borders and look each other in the face and say, are we going to make it or are we not? And as soon as somebody steps forward with an agenda, you know that's not the person. That's not the person you want to be talking to. Because the agenda can only be designed by people who have faith in other people and do not see themselves as the oracle of truth of any sort. So I sit in a time of puzzlement, and what I'm trying to write about in Horizon is where from here? I spend a lot of time talking about James Cook, an Enlightenment hero, and a person who in the last 50 years has been sharply criticized for his racial views and his sense of British exceptionalism. But given the tools that he had and the atmosphere he was growing up in, I think he did a really remarkable job of helping us understand the world that we have a stake in. Traditional people have a stake in a localized economy and in a localized geography. Now we're looking for somebody who has a much different sense of the world and of how to make it work for people in terms of fresh water, protein, no flaming methane gas igniting out of the unfreezing tundra. And as I said before, you need a kind of person that is just not celebrated in American culture, and that's a grown-up.
So should we look to native culture in this?
Sorry?
Should we look to native culture in this country for answers
models? I think you go to native cultures and say they know as much about the difficulty we're in as we do, but they're never asked to the table. I mean, look at a photograph in a newspaper of the people that are invited to a table to talk about human fate. They all look the same. That's probably not a good starting place, you know. I think you can say, without disparaging the women's movement or the environmental movement or the Native American, I can't remember which one I just said, any of these movements of the late 20th century, once you came up out of the particulars of the objection, the central objection, you see that they were all saying the same thing. Hierarchy will be the death of us. If you say men are better than women, blacks are worse than whites, if you start thinking like that, it's just a dead end. And it's basically stupid to believe that one kind of human being is able to set a standard of exceptionalism that should be followed by everyone. First of all, everyone doesn't want to do that. I'm repeating myself. Is there an answer to the dilemma? Yes. And the answer is to listen. You know, everywhere I go and everywhere I was when I was writing this book, I just tried to listen. The world is sick of listening to people who believe they are exceptional telling them how to succeed in life. What is the success that you want? If you're a child, you're saying, you know, you want $1 million or something, you know. What you want is to exist in a reciprocated atmosphere of love. You want to be able to express your love without being mocked or disparaged. You want to have within yourself a capacity to receive love. You want to live in that nexus. And you don't want to perpetuate or enhance the value of violence. There's always going to be violence. But you can reduce the level of cruelty, and you can focus instead on a capacity for compassion and for courage, the kinds of things that that elders in traditional societies have always said, these are the things worth pursuing. The rest of it, you know, it's. I do think that that's possible, and you know, I can recall nights in Kabul where the vehicle I was in was stopped every 500 feet by some armed militia, and all of us were pulled out of the vehicle, and you know, it's somebody's violent insistence that they are right in the world and you are not, and their desire to kill you. And that goes on all over the world. But it does, because it's perpetuated by people like, I don't know, a particular politician in our lives is coming to mind at the moment. We're sunk, if that's what it's going to be. And I don't, you know, when I remember walking in these, I took a group of men out to one night into dinner in Banda Aceh. I can't remember now. I think five men, myself and a translator. And every one of these people had lost everybody in their family. You know, the tsunami hit Banda Aceh in about 8:30 local time on a Sunday morning. These are conservative Muslim people. So it's Saturday is the holy day and not Sunday. So they were out, all of the men were out fishing, and the tsunami passed underneath their boats. They knew what it was. It was about a foot high and flying at about 60 miles an hour. And everybody knew when it gets closer to shore, it's going to rise up, which it did in some places 80 feet, and just take everything. Just take everything. I stood in a tower in a mosque where I could see a landscape that was shredded to the point where absolutely nothing was there except the painted concrete floors of houses that were level with the ground. Everything else was gone. You know, this empty, there's a dog collar with a rope on it. Where the dog was, or you know, what the story of that was. It was total destruction. So I took all these men out to dinner one night and asked them each to explain to me the nature of his grief and what was to be done about it. You know, and these were men who had lost a wife, lost a wife's parents, lost their own parents, lost all of their children, lost all of their aunts and uncles, like, 18, 19, 23 people in that home, gone, never found again. You know, pick a number, you know, 80,000 just out there in the Indian Ocean somewhere. And when you see those people reorganize themselves, begin a family again, I think, we know how to do this. We know how to do this. And you leave it to the women and men who have the capacity to comfort others and to not panic and to be sure that everything is okay. One of the really big differences for me between my experience with Aboriginal thought and tribal social dynamics and our culture is the tendency for us is, and this goes back thousands of years, I think, is to wait for the hero, to wait for somebody who comes along that you can believe in, and they tend to say, follow me, I know. And we fall into that trap all the time. And that's what makes, you know, say the current debate about elections in 2020, so it makes me so sad. Follow me, I know the way. And we are all thinking, no, something else has got to be working here. In traditional societies, what you find is, first of all, the society exists for so long because the goal is social stability. It's not, say, progress. The most important thing is to maintain a stable society that can deal with whatever comes along. You know, we're turning out technology every day that absolutely nobody really understands what the consequences are. I mean, today we are paying the bill for the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century with cancer, for example. So these ideas that seem like the perfect answer and the way to go turn out to be not so good. So in traditional societies, instead of saying, let's wait for somebody to come along who's really bright and heroic and we can follow him, and they say, follow me. Instead of that, elders concentrate with each, it's never one elder. It's a group of women and men who are trusted by a larger group of people to be the ones who know what's really going on. And their idea is, leave nobody behind. As soon as you develop a plan that moves this group over to the periphery, or that group over to the periphery, you will falter. So the idea is to make decisions that will take care of everybody, and if we don't do that, it's better to go out all together than it is to have one little group with its special agenda and its isolation from the rest because they have more money or something like that. It's immoral. Either we all take care of each other and we all watch out over each other and we all comfort each other and recognize that some people have too much stress in their lives to manage doing recycling or whatever the thing is, and take care of them. You either do that or you just watch it all disintegrate further, I think.
Well, we certainly don't want that to happen. I'd like to open it to the audience for a question or two.
Mr. Lopez, just wondering, in your travels in this book, did you revisit any of the places in Arctic Dreams or places like it and compare and contrast?
You know, I did. I traveled fanatically in my 40s and 50s. I couldn't get enough of jumping into another plane and taking off for another continent. And I became suspicious of that. I thought, goodness, what are you running from? Why are you devouring the countryside like this? And I began to think, well, if I went back to some place, I bet I would find a completely different place, even though I went to the same place. So I did go back and visited places that I had been in as a younger man, because my effort was to say, what did you learn? Did you learn anything, or were you just traveling all the time? When I was starting to outline this book, I decided that I wanted to go to five places. One is a small island in the Canadian High Arctic called Skraeling, and work there in an archaeological camp that was addressing a group of people called Tule people, who were there about 900 years ago, who developed a way of life that allowed them to survive under really tremendously difficult circumstances. I knew that they had been able to survive against the odds, and I wanted to go look at that. What does that look like? And then I wanted to go to Galapagos to get a better idea of how evolution works, how change occurs. And so it's a large, long consideration of Darwin there. And then I went to northern Kenya. I became friends with Richard Leakey, and I asked him if I could go out with his group that search for hominid fossils and just look with them for our hominin ancestors. And that takes into account a lot of things that happened while I was doing that. And then to go to Australia, where I'd made a number of trips to Australia, so it was familiar ground, but always something new to see. And then I began going to Antarctica, actually a couple of years after I finished Arctic Dreams, I started going there. And I went back and forth there for about 20 years. I went as a professional diver. I went and camped with other people in the interior of Antarctica, partly because Antarctica seemed like a tabula rasa for me, a really empty place. Lots of physics, lots of chemistry, and no biology. So if we start at that point, what kind of idea do you have about biological life? So yes, I did go deliberately to visit places I'd been in before because I knew when I was a younger man I probably missed a lot. And then, you know, in your life you go through disruptive change, you know, you lose a child in an automobile accident or you divorce or your parents, you try to take care of your parents and they die and, you know, all of us go through that kind of stuff. And when you do, it changes, I think, the sense of what you value. What do you really value? So yeah, I did go back to a lot of places I'd been in before. And I began taking my children, you know, I took my oldest daughter to Antarctica and I took my youngest daughter when she was 14 to Cuba. And, you know, we rented a little place in Havana. And I woke up the morning that Molly, my daughter, and I, the morning after we got there, we came in at night, and I saw her out on the balcony of our room in this skirt and the wind blowing through her hair and blowing her skirt. And she turned her head this way and this way, watching people go down the sidewalk, and I thought, oh yeah, this was a good thing to do. And I learned a lot from her. I learned a lot from her by being in a place that I hadn't learned enough about.
Do you think that this current political administration that we're living with or under is going to cure us for the next couple of years after this one is gone? Do you think we'll make the same mistakes again?
Oh, of course.
Thank you.
You know, that's waiting for the hero, you know. We just get rid of these guys. I mean, I did that when I was 19 or whatever it was with Lyndon Johnson. Boy, if you get this son of a bitch out of the White House, then we end that war in Vietnam. Really? I guess that didn't work out very well. No, but it doesn't mean that, and I feel this seething in young people in American universities. Inarticulate, poorly informed about history, all of those things are true, but tremendous energy and tremendous moral hunger. And I think out of that group of young people, you can build something the likes of which you've never seen. But it will require, I think, an unusual cooperation. The model for us is older people know because they have great experience and younger people don't because they don't have any experience. I don't really think that's true anymore. Young people have the rate of change per unit of time for them has accelerated way beyond what is the case for us. I'm 74. But what I see now is it's not the mentor-mentee relationship. It's the collaborative relationship between people who are focused on a different moral order, and where one can't appreciate the complexity of some part of it, the other can. I think the most important thing that could happen now is for women and men to collaborate with each other outside of the this antiquated 19th century idea of the nation state. It is basically a useless way to organize ourselves against global climate change or the whole long list of things, including the collapse of democratic governments and the rise of petty criminals in positions of power. And I think that can happen. I mean, one of the reasons I enjoy going to universities and meeting with students is, I was about to say their hilarious energy, but it's they are determined to make something better, and they will. And I think it's for many of us, we've got to get ourselves over that hump where we know and they don't, and make common cause. I feel that everywhere I go in the so-called third world, that you can make common cause with people very different from yourself, and you're not going to become like each other. These epistemological differences, the different ways in which we see the world and in which we set up a hierarchical arrangement of what is important and what is not, that's never going to be ironed out. But there is something in each person that understands when you create a just environment, when you encourage courage against tyranny, everybody gets that. Those are not things that are particular to one religion. They are particular to the nature of humanity. And you know, what I was trying to do in Horizon is to say, here's some of what that might look like. I don't understand policy. I don't know how to make policy for social change. But I know many women and men do. So my job is just to tell a story. My job is to tell a story that engages people and leave those people to make the decisions I would never attempt to make. And when they do, I want to be there to say, what do you want me to do? And essentially, that's how Aboriginal societies function. Nobody feels, oh, my voice wasn't heard. As long as the elders in a village communicate to you that everyone is respected, then it's easy for you who know who the smart people are to say, okay, what do you want me to do? You don't say, hey, I have to be included. You are included.
Please join me in thanking Barry Lopez.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.